Hello and welcome to the Christmas edition of Gascast. By way of celebrating the birth of the baby Jesus, in this episode we're going to be looking at the most recent CMACE report. Mark is going to be playing the part of wise man and bring us gifts of new RSI protocols, and I'm going to be finding out how much my co-presenters have been overindulging over the Christmas period and how it will make them look stupid if they have to have rather than give an anaesthetic. Frank is then going to let the side down by talking about ECMO. I'm Rick Thomas, and joining me are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Frank Schneider.
Hi there.
And Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
So this is going to be our sixth episode, which is five more than I think we'd all thought we'd manage. In 2012, we would love to hear from you and have your input into the podcast. So if there's something you'd like us to talk about or discuss, or maybe something you think everyone else should know about, please get in touch via the Contact Us button on the website. We'd love to hear from you. So we'll kick off as usual with Discovery of the Month. And Frank, what Yuletide discoveries did Santa leave in your stocking?
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but mine's not very Christmassy, but I think it's pretty cool. And what it amounts to is extreme vagal maneuver. And it was demonstrated to me by a very nice pediatric cardiac surgeon when we were recently doing a pediatric case, obviously, with an open chest. And the child had just gone into an SVT, or we weren't sure if it was an SVT or just very fast sinus tachy. And does anyone want to hazard a guess what vagal maneuver you can do in that specific scenario?
Traction on the heart, I reckon. Grab and
or
yank.
Scrotum.
It's yes, cardiac well, surgery.
The heart was more accessible than the scrotum.
Okay, I wasn't really listening.
And there Frank is doing this year at a centre of excellence. JP dissing his.
Yeah, no, I will suggest that to the surgeon in question next time I see him. But no, a bit of cold saline dropped or dribbled onto the heart, it turns out, is a very effective vagal manoeuvre. And it slowed the rate down from 180 to about 90 or so, which revealed P waves. And what was pretty cool is that every time it went back up again, you could just repeat it, and it worked every time to very good effect.
So there's thermoreceptors on the pericardium, or on the actual myocardium?
Well, yeah, on the myocardium, because yeah, the pericardium was open. I mean, they had exposed the heart already, and it was towards the end of the case, so we'd come off bypass and had rewarmed. They obviously specifically, although they had room temperature warm saline, there was a bit of a confusion with the nursing staff, I think, because he was obviously specifically looking for cold saline. And then once he just literally put a few drops onto the atrium.
That is amazing.
Very cool.
Is it temperature receptors, or is it a direct effect on the action potential in the myocardium?
No, I think it must. No, I suspect it is temperature related, because when he did it, I should have explained that the confusion with the nursing staff is that they gave him some warm saline first, and that actually didn't have an effect. Well, no, sorry, he didn't actually do the warm saline, I suppose, because he didn't think that was going to work. So I imagine that, yeah, it must be temperature related, or perhaps it's just more effective with cold. But obviously it just elicits the vagal response you're trying to achieve.
Very difficult to sort of use in a practical way, because you're never normally faced with an open chest and an SVT at the same time.
No, I mean, I wouldn't suggest that at your next ALS course as a vagal manoeuvre.
Open the chest and go to the freezer.
You're better just to blow on the syringe, aren't you?
Well, thanks very much for that, Frank. Bex, what discovery has been decorating your Christmas practice?
Well, mine is not amazingly exciting, and it is not that unusual, but I did think it was a good discovery considering it's Christmas time and most people are quite skint. We're having recession and our own time of austerity.
Is it related to the Difficult Airway Society?
It is not. However, it is something I found online, and it's actually on the AAGBI website. It's their new education video directory. And it's really good. They have about 60 videos of people speaking at conferences, and you can watch them as a video on one half of the screen And on the other half of the screen, they've got the speaker's slides that they were presenting at the conference. And so I just think it's brilliant because you can't afford to go to all of the conferences, and actually at a lot of conferences you wouldn't want to listen to all the speakers, but they've just chosen a select few that say really interesting things or things that are new. And yeah, you can watch them for free. I thought it was absolutely excellent. I've watched three so far and they've all been really good.
Do you get a certificate if you listen to them?
No, but you suggest it, I think. But I suppose it's hard to be sure. How would you know that you were paying attention? Because you could probably put it on while you cook or something.
You could say the same for a conference. And you always get a certificate then.
True.
So yeah, and what are they from AAGBI meetings and conferences?
No. They're from all different conferences all around the world, that, you know, from ESRA or from... there's some on there from EPBOM. There's loads of different ones. Yeah, it's really good.
Because I was going to say, yeah, ESRA have quite a lot of them on their website as well.
Yeah, there's all different topics. I must say the downside, it's not particularly well, the library isn't that well sorted at the moment. So it's just got them on different pages and they haven't been categorized. So you just have to page through a bit to find what you want. But yeah, there's a lot on early goal-directed therapy and sort of controversies and a lot on sort of how to do TEVA or depth of anesthesia monitoring. I thought it was really good and free.
Probably not as many views as a 2-year-old biting a 1-year-old's finger.
No, sadly not.
Probably not.
I'll be sure to tune in once I've watched every bit of television ever made.
Oh, actually, but I'll tell you something that is worth watching on YouTube. But there's one of the pediatricians at St. George's, Andrew Ham. He's got a skit on YouTube called Andy Ham Amused Moose. And it is just brilliant. Highly recommend a watch.
Awesome. We'll make sure we link to that. Mark, have you discovered anything other this month than the true meaning of Christmas?
Well, I'm a little underprepared because I was, of course, expecting to be doing Undetectable Murder of the Month, as we discussed last time.
You can do an Undetectable Murder if you like.
You did your homework.
I forgot about that. Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah, but I have a backup.
I decided it was slightly inappropriate, so didn't mention it.
Okay. Well, if you're interested, oxygen embolus. But otherwise.
Genius. How long did you to come up with that?
Well, my car journey home.
About 5 patients.
Yeah.
And not one conviction.
So, my backup plan is a good old-fashioned smartphone app recommendation.
Das?
This one is not specifically medical, but has a lot of uses. It is the Google Translate app, which very simply will translate anything you want to write or speak into your phone into a huge variety of languages and back again. With a lot of the common languages, it'll speak it out loud for you. And then there are even more languages which will just display it on a full screen so that if and when we encounter patients who don't understand English, you can have your phone ask them questions or give them information in a way they should understand.
That's very cool. Is that a free app?
Yep.
Amazing.
That sounds great. Able so did you come across that in a clinical setting or were you just...
No, somebody I work with recommended it for that purpose. Yeah. For
how much
situations
is it?
And it's free.
Oh.
Absolutely fantastic. I can't follow that with anything nearly as good. But I've got a trio of local anaesthetic related facts.
I hope they're all Christmas related.
No, they're not remotely, sadly. But they have been directly useful, or at least two of them have. You know when you have a patient who's just come back for an operation and they've had a catheter put in because they're going to be immobile for a while and they're actually relatively pain-free if they've had sort of an upper abdominal operation, they've got a good working thoracic epidural, but they're getting catheter pain and that's their main complaint and you've tried some Buscopan. This is something that I'd not come across before, but I think you get 5 mils of 1% lignocaine, mix it in with 20 mils of saline, flush it up into the bladder, clamp it for about 10-15 minutes, and then let it back out again, and takes away catheter-related pain, which is quite interesting.
That is genius.
That is genius.
That is pretty good, I think.
And I've seen that work with remarkable effect. but not quite as remarkable as the next one, which was a had a patient who, you know, with sort of chronic pancreatitic patient who's had chronic pain for almost a decade and is on all sorts of fentanyl patches, Oramor, Foxycodone, and then goes and has an operation and is very difficult to look after because they've got their acute on chronic pain. This patient was basically on a background morphine infusion, on a ketamine infusion, having PRN clonidine, and was still yelping in pain every 5 minutes. The nurse didn't know what to do, and I was completely outside my spectrum of experience. But a pain specialist came in and gave an IV lignocaine infusion. I think it was something like 3 milligrams per kilogram over 20 or over 4 hours. Can't remember.
Don't use that dose.
Absolutely. Look it up or ask an expert. But anyway, it was an IV lignocaine infusion and worked wonders. I'm sure this must be written up somewhere in the literature and I'll find it and stick it on the notes. But absolutely amazing. Turned this patient around who, as I said, was on background morphine and background ketamine. And then my third local anaesthetic discovery was in, I think it's the September-October issue of Anaesthesia, where it's a case report on a patient who'd had a cocaine overdose, which you normally associate with coronary vasospasm, massive MI and cardiac arrhythmia, which I think this patient did have, but they were also comatosed. But what they did was treat it with a lipid emulsion, as you would any other local anaesthetic overdose, such as bupivacaine, and turned the patient around, which I thought was really clever to think of doing that.
Yeah, I saw that, because that was actually a case report from a hospital Mark and I worked at. I don't know if you saw it, Mark. But yeah, I thought that was really quite interesting as well.
Yeah, I thought it was a good piece of lateral thinking there, where you sort of, you wouldn't normally think about it, but you think, yeah, cocaine is in fact a local anaesthetic, gives them some lipid emulsion. So, that's my my local anaesthetic discovery.
You've got to wonder how the IV lignocaine helps with pain, which is presumably systemic, whether it is just from lignocaine getting into neural tissue.
The same with... I don't know. I mean, it's an extension. It's a slight extension of the phenomenon with the injecting it into the bladder, although that's less of a sort of...
See, but I think that's really practically useful, isn't it? Where did that come from? Who?
It was someone I work with. Just this patient was having catheter pain, and he just got on and did it. And
I don't know about the rest of you, but I mean, I've certainly had calls about that kind of thing, and I do find it quite a tricky... pain to treat, and that sounds like a great idea.
He said it works about 75% of the time.
Yeah.
Doesn't always, but yeah, most impressed. Anyway, we should probably crack on with our news items. And so, Frank, you're going to be talking to us about ECMO and the recent piece in JAMA.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm starting because mine's the most dry and boring.
Mine will give yours a run for its money, don't worry.
Actually, no, having looked at the CMOS report, you're quite right. I am ahead of the crowd here. But yeah, I mean, I'm sure this isn't what you had in mind, Rick, when you asked us to think of Christmas items. But of course, there is a lot of talk about ECMO because the winter season is coming along. And the two articles I had a look at were, some of you may remember, and here in the UK there was the CSER trial, which was published in The Lancet in 2009. And really that was comparing conventional treatment versus ECMO, or extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, for severe adult respiratory failure. And that was a multicenter randomized controlled trial that did garner a lot of interest in the UK. One of the things to point out for that was that it was had a slightly different twist to it, in the sense that it was looking at cost effectiveness of ECMO, because obviously one of the things against ECMO is the fact that it is very costly treatment, and that it's run in very specialised centres, and they looked at quality of life issues as well, and treatment costs of, and whether or not they would be justified. In any case, that's obviously not the article I was discussing for this podcast. But rather, as Rick says, the one in JAMA, which was published this year, just a couple of months ago, and the CSER trial has really been backed up by more recent evidence following the 2009 H1N1 influenza cases that were seen in the UK. And I suppose really to summarise the trial, it's just, it does, and those of you who will read it or have read it, we'll see that it's got quite robust statistical analysis, and although it's a reasonably difficult population group, they've actually done looked at three different matching methods. They did propensity matching as well as individual matching of cases, and then a new method of matching cases, and obviously matching ECMO-referred patients to non-ECMO-referred patients, called GenMatch, which is supposed to be a combination of propensity and individual matching. And I'm sure Rick got very excited about the statistical discussion.
I did. I've been reading up about propensity.
Propensity.
propensity scoring. Got some comments on it, so sorry, carry on.
But essentially, I mean, the sort of summary conclusion of the paper is that they did show much improved and certainly statistically significant survival in patients referred for ECMO as compared to those who weren't referred for ECMO. And this also builds on the back of the Australian and New Zealand study, which showed survival of up to 70% in H1N1 ECMO-referred patients. And in fact, those survival rates in the numbers reported here for the 2009 flu cases are similar survival rates. And the other reason I thought that was of interest is that here in the UK, as many of you may know already, we have now, on the back of a lot of the ECMO research and obviously the flu cases that we've seen over the last couple of years, there are the UK government is dedicated four ECMO centres. One of them is at the Brompton, and the other one in Papworth, Glenfield, which is where the biggest ECMO centre in the UK, where much of this work started. And there's one other up in Scotland. I can't remember now exactly where. And obviously with winter coming, and although I've not seen a lot of swine flu cases or H1N1 cases, but we probably will, and given the results of these trials, probably will be seeing ECMO play a more and more important role in the treatment of severe respiratory failure. Do you have any issues to take on the statistical analysis and propensity matching, Rick?
I didn't really have any issues on it, because obviously some very clever people have done some very clever stats. But I think for people who are not statistically minded or haven't come across propensity scoring before, it's worth just mentioning a couple of things to do with both the CSER trial and the paper done in JAMA. The first thing to say about the paper in JAMA, once you're using something like propensity scoring, you're looking at an observational study, which is obviously not quite the same level of evidence as a randomised controlled trial, which the CSER trial was, I think, a randomised controlled trial, although one of the important things to remember about that was that the intervention was referral to an ECMO centre, not in fact ECMO itself, because in the ECMO group only 75% actually received ECMO. And there's a further point to that, which I'll come to in a minute. So the one in JAMA is actually, it's an observational study, which is why you do propensity score matching. And the basis of it, as I understand it, is you're kind of looking retrospectively and you're trying to match the two groups. And obviously the group in the JAMA paper, I think, was it 80 patients, Frank? Is that right?
Yeah.
It was a relatively small number that were matched from a massive population of people who fitted certain criteria. And what you're trying to allow for are confounding factors that would have biased your population that got treated with getting that particular treatment. And this is what propensity scoring tries to sort of let you do. However, and this is the other point, there are other confounding factors, which they do mention in the paper, that you can't allow for, such that some of the people who they're going to be matched with might have been too sick for ECMO. There's missing data that they don't have on some of the patients they're matching with. It's not possible to know what treatment they actually have, whether or not they had lung protective ventilation. So it's not as... The reason I mention this is because the relative risk ratios they came up with were quite astonishing. You just look at the percentages, it was sort of 74% versus 45% survival in certain groups. But the relative risks were all sort of around the 0.5 or 0.45 mark, which is very impressive. But there are, you kind of have to take it in context of the propensity score matching, the relatively small numbers, although obviously the statistics sort of compensate for that. But also, interestingly, I went to quite recently a cardiothoracic intensive care meeting at the AAGBI, which is very good. And they had somebody coming down from Leicester, which is one of the ECMO centres, isn't it?
Yeah.
Talking about their experience with ECMO during the 2009 flu season. And what really stuck out was how very special the unit was where they were doing the ECMO, how very special the patients were and how they were treated and how they had, you know, you got the impression that this unit was really striving to do very well with this one specialist group of patients compared to, and I think this is one of the criticisms of the CESAR trial, the people who didn't get referral, you kind of didn't, there was no particular protocol that they were managed on.
So yeah, absolutely. I mean, but that is, in defense of the paper, I mean, that is something the authors highlight.
Absolutely.
Not only Leicester or Glenfield, but obviously all the centres are centres that are well experienced in provision of ECMO for other clinical scenarios, and probably were better staffed, probably had higher level of interest, certainly, and you could argue possibly more rigorous protocols when it came to ventilation. So even those patients who didn't get ECMO were, as was published in the CESAR trial, were managed along very strict guidelines in terms of lung protective strategies. And as you say, in the CESAR trial, for those who weren't referred, they obviously had no control. I mean, they gave advice as to what should be done, but they clearly had no control over what or how those patients were treated.
No, absolutely. But it certainly looks like a very promising way of treating these patients. And I'm sure, I mean, the government has been having set up all of these specialist centres, we're going to see more of it happening. And it obviously is very effective. One thing, has anybody actually ever seen any ECMO done?
No. We had two of our patients with bronchiolitis go for ECMO, though. But they did wait for ages for these kids to be absolutely on the last legs, really, because apparently in children it's got really high risk of complications. Higher than in adults, and so
I mean that is a completely different population category, I think. And
what's interesting with the adults, when they showed us some of the pictures that this lecture I was at, was the size of the ECMO line you put in is a jugular venous line, but these things were absolutely enormous. They showed chest x-rays of the patients with them in, and they looked like a really, really frightening thing to have to do, to put in one of these ECMO lines. You put it in, and then you have to, I think it's got a port, sort of a bit like a Murphy's eye on a ET tube, that you have to line up with the right atrium, or the opening of the right atrium. So they're technically quite difficult to put in, but they just look absolutely enormous, really, really frightening. I'm actually trying to find an image on Google, but I can't see one. But yeah, thank you very much for that, Frank. Very seasonal, but
for all the wrong reasons.
Sadly not Christmassy. Mark.
Yes.
I know that it's an interesting time in pre-hospital medicine for rapid sequence intubation and maybe moving away from the traditional model that we're all taught.
That's right. It's big changes afoot, particularly in the southeast of England, driven by London Hems. As usual, and it's been a long time coming. The main change I'm going to talk about is the drug protocol, really, for doing pre-hospital RSIs. And the background to this comes from in the olden days, people doing pretty much what they wanted with variable success, which has evolved over the last 20 years or so into a very regimented, protocol-driven system whereby everyone was giving etomidate and sux for RSIs. And that has a proven track record now, which is why it's taken quite a while to change. Although we often hear from hospital anaesthetists, why are you still using those old crappy drugs? There are several good reasons. Mainly that we need our rapid sequences to be rapid, and that rules out quite a lot of drugs straight away. And more than ever, we need hemodynamic stability. So things like thiopentone and propofol just can't be tolerated by trauma patients who are often under-resuscitated and hypovolemic. So that doesn't leave many options. Ketamine was always traditionally ruled out because of fears about raised intracranial pressure. So that kind of left etomidate, which is cardiovascularly stable, even in hemodynamically compromised patients. And what we needed in the pre-hospital world was a protocol that would work for anybody, so that a different doctor and paramedic teams who may or may not have worked together were expecting the same things and not throwing each other curveballs when asking for unusual or complicated regimes. And this has worked. This has worked very well for a while. At London HEMS Governance last week, they presented their data, and they now have on their books something like 7,000 pre-hospital RSIs with a fail rate of, a success rate of 99.4%, I think, from memory, which is more than comparable with most of the rest of the world, and considerably better than some countries like America, for instance, where a lot of the...
Sorry, Mark, is that success rate of intubation?
That's the success rate of intubation. So that's people who, okay, not necessarily at the first attempt, but people who have ended up with a cuffed endotracheal tube as opposed to a surgical airway or a supraglottic device or a wake-up and resume breathing. So having established the safety of the protocol, people started thinking about refining it so that not only would it be safe, but it would be more forgiving to the patient's physiology. Because one problem with the etomidate and sux regime is, first of all, it doesn't really suppress a pressor response to laryngoscopy. So people were getting a fairly big surge in blood pressure after intubation, and that's compounded by the fact that etomidate is well out of favour these days because of its effects on steroidogenesis. Most of that work has, of course, been done in sepsis, but there are a lot of parallels. Trauma patients are often in ITU for a while and become septic or have a very similar systemic inflammatory response, and it's now thought that these effects of etomidate can occur after even just the one intubation dose, so people don't like it. A lot of the recent work on ketamine has shown that it doesn't really increase intracranial pressure, and more importantly, it will usually slightly increase your mean arterial pressure and therefore your current cerebral perfusion pressure in combination with reducing your cerebral metabolic rate for oxygen, providing a generally more favourable ratio of supply and demand for people with a traumatic brain injury. So ketamine is being used more and more and is now the induction agent of choice for the London HEMS RSI protocol.
So what dose, What dose are you using?
The standard dose will be 2 milligrams per kilo body weight, and half that if you've got a patient who's really unstable.
What's the... I thought one of the problems with ketamine as an induction agent for an RSI was that its onset's a little bit on the slow side.
It's not too bad. I've got a paper here from Anesthesia in 2009, a review article about anesthesia in the hemodynamically compromised emergency patients. And it's a good review article. As well as looking at the evidence, they look at the theory behind it and the pharmacokinetics. And they reckon the... effector site equilibration half-life of ketamine is probably around 2 minutes, which compares with 1.5 minutes for thiopentone, 2.5 minutes for etomidate. If you go up to something like fentanyl, which I'm sure Frank's using lots of at the moment, we're looking at about 6 minutes, so not really fast enough on its own. Propofol, interestingly, is up to 20 minutes. It's just... any of these drugs, if you give enough of them, you'll make that faster, but you'll get more of the unwanted effects. So ketamine is not really that slow if you give a decent enough dose, is the answer to that.
And that's 2 milligrams per kilo.
2 milligrams per kilo. Now, prior to that, to attenuate the pressor response, we're going to be using fentanyl, which we all know and love. So a fairly robust dose of around, or not around, exactly 3 milligrams per kilo prior to induction.
So are you giving that in what sort of succession? Like fentanyl, ketamine, sucks in just bam, bam, bam? Or do you wait?
I think, I mean, that's not specified in the new standard operating procedure, but I think talking to people in the business, I think that'll be a kind of pragmatic decision based on the situation. So you'll do your, you'll prepare your kit, you'll do your checklist, and then you'll start giving the drugs. Now, if the patient's stable relatively, I think it would be prudent to wait a minute or two between the fentanyl and the ketamine. Yeah. But if you need to get it done, then you need to get it done. That's my own interpretation of what's come out. It's all still very new, and it's being discussed at the moment, but hasn't been put into practice yet.
Do you know when they're planning to roll it out?
In the new year. In the new year in London, and shortly afterwards with some of our other services.
Is replacing suck something that's up for?
Absolutely. So the third new drug is rocuronium. And again, the sucks was always the first choice for RSIs in and out of hospital in the textbooks. But as you know, we've talked about it before, the recent work and the Cochrane database review shows that rocuronium, when given in a significant enough dose, can provide just as good intubating conditions just as quickly. And furthermore, in the 7,000 London HEMS RSIs that have been done, I think there are only two cases of people backing out and successfully waking a patient up. It's just really not going to happen, because to get to the decision to do an RSI in that setting, the patient's going to need it, and waking up's not going to be an option.
But presumably in your population, if you know, failed intubation, you would just go for a surgical airway.
Exactly.
In which case, it doesn't really matter if you can't wake them up.
Well, exactly. And even more than not mattering, if you're going to be doing a surgical airway, you don't want to be doing it on someone whose sucks is starting to wear off.
Yeah,
so that's very much the teaching is you commit yourself to the RSI, you give 1 milligram per kilo of rocuronium, and then you will secure an airway. There is a failed intubation drill built into the standard operating procedure, which
does that include Sugammadex?
It doesn't. Sugammadex will not be carried. It's not practical.
Failure is not an option.
Failure is not an option. Positive mental attitude is a big player. No, for the same reasons as you wouldn't use sucks and wake somebody up. You're not going to draw up 4 ampules of Sugammadex on a roadside and start doing that. It's not practical, and it.
You're certainly not going to wake them up if you give them 2 milligrams per kilogram of ketamine.
Well, exactly.
Yeah, not in a hurry.
I think sucks will still be carried for the anticipated difficult airways. It's being left in as an option for now. I don't think it will be needed very often.
That sounds very progressive, and I've got to say I'm really pleased to see sucks going off the menu, certainly, because if it's starting to go off the menu with HEMS, I think we'll be seeing less and less of it used in hospitals, which I personally
think
is a good thing.
And the topic of another entirely different podcast.
That is really interesting.
I think that is very sensible, although it does... I don't know how everyone feels about Tomodate, but I do still think it gets a bit of a bum rap.
I don't know. It's all I've used for induction for the last 3 or 4 months, and I haven't had any problems with it, but then I wouldn't. I'm not, you know, dealing with the patient down the line.
You don't look after the patient afterwards.
It does what it's supposed to do. It was chosen because of its stability, and you know we don't know our patients' weights accurately or comorbidities, so we need drugs that, you know, you can over or under do it by 10 or 20% and not cause a massive amount of problems. And it's a slow process, but London have consulted the biggest of cheeses in the world of anaesthesia and pre-hospital emergency medicine, and taken a good long time consulting and discussing. And
because we reviewed an article recently about use of Tomodate for induction in cardiac surgery, specifically with a view to see if they had increased noradrenaline requirements post-op due to suppression of endogenous steroid synthesis. And again, I mean, that just actually, I mean, they did have slightly longer use of ion traps, but it wasn't clinically significant. And likewise, with Etomidate, isn't there good evidence that a single dose actually has no effect on your steroid synthesis?
I thought it was completely the opposite. I thought it was very good evidence that one single dose blocked 11-beta hydroxylase.
It does block it. But there was, again, there was no clinically significant effect for blocking it for the duration of the dose. It was only repeated doses and then obviously infusions that were detrimental.
This paper in Anesthesia quotes the Corticus study that confirmed that steroid suppression occurred in 60% of septic patients who received Etomidate compared with 43 who did not, indicating that the adverse effects are possibly important even after a single bolus dose. I think what people were struggling with was that a lot of the senior HEMS doctors are also senior anaesthetists or emergency physicians, and we're having increasing conflict with why would they do one thing when receiving a patient in the emergency department and something completely different if they were out on the road. They wanted to take the best possible standard of care to the patient. Just because the conditions are difficult doesn't mean you should give a less optimal anaesthetic.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, I think, as Rick says, it's very progressive thinking, and sadly probably takes someone like HEMS and, you know, lessons from the military to actually get it into common practice.
Well, hopefully in a couple of months' time you can update us on how that's going with your ketamine, rocuronium RSIs, or maybe follow up on your blog on the website.
Definitely. I mean, and again, I'm not advocating that everyone goes out and changes their practice overnight, but I think ketamine's on an upstroke of this sine wave of popularity, and people should be familiarizing themselves with it and learning about it, and watch this space.
So, good news for fans of ketamine everywhere. Moving on to Rebecca and your news item, you're going to be telling us about the CMAC/CMACE report and hopefully giving us a clue about what they're going to call it next time around.
Yeah, so for my news item, I'm going to talk about the CMACE report, and it used to be known as the CMAC report, but now it's the Centre for Maternal and Child Inquiries, and it's a self-governing charity. It's changed its name because it's now funded by the National Patient Safety Agency, not by NICE. And the point of the CMACE report is to look into maternal deaths in the UK, and they make a triennial report entitled Saving Mothers' Lives, and it's been going on since the 50s. Now, this most recent report, it covers the years 2006 to 2008, and it investigates the deaths of 261 women that died in the UK, either during their pregnancy or up to 28 days postpartum. And in the report, deaths are categorized as either direct or indirect deaths, the direct ones being from medical conditions that can only be a result of pregnancy, so, for example, preeclampsia. And indirect deaths are from pre-existing medical conditions which have been influenced by pregnancy, so something like cardiac disease. Now, the good news is that there is significant reduction in the overall UK maternal death rate. This is predominantly due to a drop in the number of fatalities from venous thromboembolism and hemorrhage. Unfortunately, there is a dramatic increase in the number of deaths from sepsis, particularly group A strep, which is now the sepsis being the leading cause of direct deaths. The indirect rates have actually remained largely unchanged, and cardiac disease is still the most common cause of that, as it was in the previous report. So there's risk factors that are identifiable in patients that should be sort of like red flags: that increasing maternal age, smoking, obesity, ethnic minority groups, the history of domestic abuse, or just being known to social services. Unfortunately, avoidable factors, they said that substandard care was identified in nearly three quarters of the direct deaths and over half of the indirect deaths. And one of the focus in the recommendations of this report is really just on going back to basics. So really simple things like comprehensive history taking at booking. If you make a referral to a specialist, you need to follow up and make sure that appropriate actions have been taken. And not only just using one of those modified early obstetric warning scores, but actually acting on those observations that you've so carefully documented. And finally, just not attributing all symptoms to those of normal pregnancy or labor. So, for example, chest pain in a woman who is laboring may not actually be labor pains. It may be aortic dissection, something like that. I must admit, I didn't read the entire 205-page report. But in the comprehensive report, I did read the chapter on anaesthetics, and there are 7 deaths which are considered to be directly due to anaesthesia, which is up from the 6 on the previous report. It does make for a fairly harrowing read. I think, I'm sure for you guys as well, a death in a young, fit, new mother must be just about your worst nightmare. And they've split them up into 3 categories. So there was patients that died from failure to ventilate, patients that died from post-op complications, and then 1, leukoencephalitis. Of the patients that failure to ventilate, the first one is a really horrible case report. It's a patient who had an induction of general anaesthetic for an emergency cesarean section, and there was a trainee involved. They weren't able to intubate. They did, however, manage to ventilate through an intubating LMA, but then had an unrecognized esophageal intubation and a period of hypoxia. And the patient snuck off at some stage, and then it wasn't woken up, but was given a second dose of thiopentone and a long-acting muscle relaxant, and then died, and a cricothyroidotomy was never attempted. Now, the main learning points from that one are those anaesthetic non-technical skills, which is really involving trying to avoid target fixation and just accepting defeat. So you just know when to stop, you know, just leave your intubation and wake the patient up. I think what makes that case report even worse is that the patient had a really good functioning epidural, and when the initial decision to go to theatre was made, had they started topping it up then, they may have managed to avoid a general anaesthetic altogether, because the cesarean section was only escalated to being a Category 1 section when they were in theatre, which is at the time at which the trainee then had to start topping up, but it was too late. The second patient that died from failure to ventilate was a woman who had a no difficult airway and a tracheostomy, and she was on the intensive care. She was being rolled in her bed, and the tracheostomy fell out, and they were unable to intubate, unable to ventilate. So the criticism there was that they didn't have a strategy for this eventuality in a patient that was recognized that would have been difficult to reintubate, and just the importance of always having, you know, your plan A, your plan B, and possibly even a plan C at hand. Of the patients that died...
Sorry, was this a patient who was in ITU with a tracheostomy because of other things that had happened during the pregnancy, or was it a coincidence? Or...
Yeah, it doesn't give any details, just that she was known to have a difficult airway and had this tracheostomy inside, but you don't know if it was a long-standing one, or there's no sort of... It's not like the NAP4 report, which gives you a really comprehensive...
Is it postnatal? I mean, is she in ITU?
Is it just within 28 days, and that's why they got picked up by the CMA?
It's not that the anaesthetic chapter doesn't, you know, each case report is only sort of half a paragraph. It's not a, you know, long like the NAP4. Of these 7 cases, assessors felt that there was substandard care in 6 of them. And then of the cases that they weren't contributing directly to anaesthesia, there's about 18 cases where they thought that anaesthetics played a role in the poor outcome. One thing I thought was a bit unfair is that it was lack of anaesthetic input being sought early on, which presumably is not really an anaesthetic fault, but actually more sort of due to the obstetricians maybe not highlighting these patients to us early enough. However, there was also lack of any input from an anaesthetist and a failure to recognise serious illness, which again just brings us back to those basics about, you know, good communication being really fundamental. Just going to say that for me, as far as I'm concerned, it really highlights the fact that in labour ward, the attack is the best form of defence, and that much as I just sometimes want to hide in the room and wait to be told that there's an epidural to be done, you really would do a lot better to have a proactive rather than a reactive approach. Sobering words.
Thanks, Bex. Those are some horrible bedtime stories for all of us who work on labour ward. I think you make an interesting point about the early consultation with an anaesthetist. In fact, I'll put a link on the podcast notes to it, but there's a really nice editorial by Steve Yentis, who's obviously heavily invested in this because he was a central anaesthetic assessor for the maternal death inquiry. It's a very nice editorial just talking about what's happening, why it was CMAC, why it's CMACE. This will in fact be the last CMACE report as the organisational structure of it's changing once again. But one of his criticisms about the process of the new restructuring is that there was no anaesthetist on the primary consultation board. which is rather worrying, especially considering what you just said about not seeking anaesthetic consultation early enough. The editorial is also very noteworthy because he makes some really, really nerdy references to Doctor Who throughout, which I quite enjoy.
It's a fine line, isn't it, between being proactive and
interfering,
a more prominent member of the team. Well, a fine line between that and de-skilling the obstetricians in terms of medical management even further, and having to shoulder more, you know, the responsibility for every slightly not right patient.
I got asked to see a patient once because the obstetric registrar said to me, "This patient's got a rash. They've got a rash. I'm really worried." And I'm like, "Well, should probably call a medic." And she's like, "But aren't you the rash doctor?" No, I'm the epidural doctor. Come on, I can't do everything. But I went and saw the patient anyway, and basically what this patient had done is blown a load of capillaries in their face because they'd been pushing hard because they'd just delivered a baby.
Yeah, that's the thing. I have encountered obstetricians who treat us like we are the kind of personal medics. So anything not baby-related will come straight to us.
Anyway, that's probably enough obstetrician bashing.
Really? It's Christmas.
offline.
Can I just lighten the mood by giving you my Christmas-related paper, which was the increase of paradoxical excitement response during propofol-induced sedation in hazardous and harmful alcohol drinkers, which I thought was very topical because, it being Christmas, I'm sure many of us will be going to Christmas parties and maybe indulging in a little too much of the old ETOH. What paradoxical excitement is, and you're probably all familiar with this phenomenon, is when you give someone some propofol, send them off to sleep, and then they start flailing around and the ODP turns around and starts drawing up a second 20 mils. That's pretty much what we're talking about. Or the occasional which you may have had amorous comment made to you just as they're drifting off to sleep.
You go, Rick.
But, yeah. But what this was a Korean study on 190 patients who they categorized into either hazardous drinkers or non-hazardous drinkers using a questionnaire, which I'll come to in a bit. And then in those two groups, they did two separate studies. I should say all the patients were having elective knee joint surgery. So they're having a spinal, a tourniquet, and then TEVA propofol sedation. And they put them into two different studies, actually, that were all rolled into this one paper. One was where they went for they aimed at a certain BIS score, and one was where they aimed at an effector site concentration score. And very briefly, their hypothesis was proven, which was that in those patients who gave a heavier alcohol history, there was an increased incidence of this paradoxical excitement response, and markedly so, down to very low p-values. They had sort of 70% versus 34% in two out of three arms of the trial. The only one where there wasn't a significant response was when it was a very low-dose propofol effector site concentration used. Why is this study significant? I mean, it's probably not hugely significant. Why it interested me is because when I was an SHO, when I first discovered TEVA or the use of it, I went through a stage of trying to TEVA everybody. And you're probably all familiar with the fact that alcohol abuse attracts certain operation types. Many of those are abscesses. Many of them are perianal abscesses. And I've been on the wrong end of trying to TEVA a perianal abscess before and have them dancing around as soon as the surgeon starts sticking knives in them. And, you know, you look a bit of a wally and the surgeon's looking at you asking what you're doing. And the reason for that is it'll work very nicely on one patient, but through experience I learned that if they had any sort of significant alcohol history, this was not going to be the way to keep them still for their operation. So I like this because this study took an observation which I've actually made and obviously lots of other people have made and then put it into a nice little study, proved their hypothesis, some nice simple statistics that we can all understand, with some rationale behind it because propofol and alcohol are both GABA A agonists, potentiating the action of GABA. But the other thing I wanted to talk about was the tool they used to determine whether or not these people were in the hazardous drinking group or the non-hazardous drinking group. They used this tool called the Audit Tool, which stands for Alcohol Use Disorder Identification Test, which feels like a bit of a ropey shoehorning to me. But nonetheless, if you put audit and alcohol into Google, you'll come up with a page where you can take the test yourself. So you all got my email beforehand, so hopefully you've all done it and can go around and give me your audit scores, and I can tell you which group you would have ended up in. So first up in the confessional booth, Mark.
Oh, I thought you had our scores.
Based on Rick's assessment of your drinking habits.
No, I thought I... Oh, did we not email it back to you? Okay.
No.
I did do it, and let me just find the...
I haven't done it.
I came out... Hang on, let's edit this out. I'll do it again.
Oh, you need to do
audit
it now.
Alcohol. Yeah. Audit, oh, I've got it, yeah. Patient.co.uk. Sweet. Where's the test? More detailed than the cage. I've done the cage before.
I'm sure I got more a higher score when I did this last time, but yeah. I've come out at 7 this time.
Oh, really?
You sound surprised.
Hey, has everybody got a score?
I think I got 9 when I did it today. I'm trying to work out. I guess if that last question. Yeah, 9.
I get 11. I didn't have children, though. I'm allowed to get a bit more.
And Frank.
And I snuck in at 7, which I'm hoping just keeps me safe.
Well, that's very interesting. Frank is the only non-hazardous drinker amongst us, as a score of 8 or more would have put us in the hazardous group, and we would have been flailing around with propofol. It's kind of I took a nap 3 approach to this, so I sort of gave myself a pessimistic score and an optimistic score.
Say, I think that the last two questions are pessimistic because I have been injured, but. Many years ago, you were there, Rick, for the main one. and question 10.
That's funny because that's the same injury that I used to score 2 points on that as well.
Yeah, well, exactly. And question 10. Whose mother didn't tell them when they were a teenager that they were worried about the drinking or whatever? So, if you ignore those two, then yeah. I would have 5 points.
But I think if your mother was concerned because you're under 18, that doesn't count. I think it means it's sort of a more overbearing concern.
No, but I mean, even after 18 and through university, I'd always get a gentle chastisement about drinking because we were, you know, students. I guess nobody sat me down for an intervention, if that's what it means.
Can I just say, in my own defence, I was doing that cycling from London to Paris, and so at one stage this year I was quite fit, and any amount of alcohol went straight to my head. And so it's not really that I'm an alcoholic, it's just I have a very low tolerance for several months.
You don't get extra points for making excuses when you hear your score, I don't think.
I would say that's a negative risk factor, starting to make excuses for yourself. It's like
probably add
yeah,
four, isn't
it? Points for that.
Excellent.
Sorry, Rick, I just wanted to ask you, because with regards to your study, I'm just interested that they didn't actually give the details of. Because one patient had to be excluded, didn't they, for bizarre behaviour. But I'd just love to know what that behaviour was, that it was bad enough to...
Oh, yeah, that's it. One patient in group HD, which is the hazardous drinking, was dropped from study 1 because of severe and uncontrollable behaviour. But the data of this patient were used for analysis of paradoxical responses. So, yes, I don't know. What that could possibly be.
I'm sure there's letters to the BGA in that.
Yeah, there must be somewhere to ask them exactly what it was. So anyway, to round off our very, very special Christmas podcast is my favourite game, Biology Bunkum, where I've worked a little bit harder than I did last week. So here are your three stories, two of which are science fact and one of which is definitely science fiction. So, the first story is, keeping with our sea mace and birth of the baby Jesus theme, is all about the science of pelvimetry, which I'm sure Bex is familiar with, being a Labour ward inhabitant, which is the study of pelvic dimensions and trying to predict whether or not there's going to be a problem with birthing. New developments are afoot with a piece of software that, once through the pregnant mother is through the MRI scanner, makes a three-dimensional reconstruction of the baby in the pelvis, presumably reasonably close to the due date, and then, using some mathematical constructs, makes 72 different potential trajectories and works out the likelihood of there being either a normal vaginal delivery or going for cesarean section. Number two is the sad story of a 27-year-old woman who has been excluded from the Paralympics. She's been excluded from the Paralympics because she is no longer paralysed. The history of this woman is that she had her first accident when she was 13. She was having surgery on her ankle, and they managed to clip some nerves, which meant that she could no longer use her right leg to cycle. And she was training for the Beijing Olympics when she had a second accident, when she was hit by a car, which left her spinal cord damaged and her paralysed from the waist down. But as she was already a Paralympian anyway, that was all right. She went on and won some medals. However, more recently, she's been in another accident where she's been hit by another cyclist and damaged her spinal cord again. This has left her with tingling sensations, and this progressed to her being able to walk. So she's now excluded from the Paralympics. And your third story is about the sad condition of anosmia, which is actually a surprisingly common complaint where people lose their sense of smell, so inhibiting, more importantly, their ability to taste various things. And it's actually quite distressing. A new technique has been developed, which is dubbed laser nose surgery, where sufferers have their olfactory nerve endings burnt slightly, very slightly, with lasers, much like you do with the same sort of sensitivity you do on laser retinal surgery. And it's been shown that, in fact, when the olfactory nerve endings grow back, the receptors regrow and, in fact, seem to have better functionality, and people get some recovery in their smell. It's a fairly simple procedure and for a quite common condition, and may in the future be offered on the high street, much in the same way that laser eye surgery is. So, of those three stories, Mark, which one do you think is the bunker?
Right, well, I think the radiology one is definitely true, because I'm good friends with a radiologist and they are super geeky. So if they can reconstruct and compute and model stuff, they definitely will. I think the cyclist Paralympian one could well be true. Sadly, cycle-on-cycle trauma is increasingly common and can be very serious. So I think, unlike the patients in the last story, I smell a rat about the anosmia.
Very nice. Very nice. Bex.
Yeah. Now, I've read that story about the cyclist on my Sky News app on my phone, so I know that that's true. I have heard of anosmia, and so I reckon that is true. So I think pelvimetry is nonsense.
Logic.
Because I just... I'm a woman.
Because you've never heard of babies being born.
I just don't think you're going to convince a woman to go into an MRI scanner. First of all, how are they going to fit in such a narrow hole with a huge lump? And 72? No, not going to happen. Rubbish. It's too many. If you'd said, like, 12 different ways of getting out or something, possibly. 72? No.
Fair enough. And that just leaves you, Frank.
Yeah, I'm going to go with the anosmia being science fiction, because although, like Bex, I've heard of anosmia, I think there's, as usual, a little bit of truth wrapped in a lot of lie.
So, taking the 27-year-old first, that is apparently true. She's kind of a very unfortunate, very accident-prone lady, and one of which seems to have turned good for her. As Bex, we all know that's the truth because it was on Sky News.
It's a step up from the Daily Mail.
I've got that app too.
We'll put a link up to that one.
I just read the showbiz.
Now, that leaves us with the other two. And Bex, I'm afraid just because you've heard of anosmia does not make it a fact. The MRI baby pelvis modelling mathematical trajectory pelvimetry story is in fact true, although not particularly well proven at the moment. There is a doctor in France who has done the radiology and the maths on this and has got a very, very small series of patients. I think it's about 11 or 12, which he's presenting at a meeting somewhere quite soon. It's an obstetric meeting, which I'll put the link to. But has had quite good results and reckons that he can, in fact, predict who's going to have problems and who's not, which is going to be really useful because it's quite often not the ones you'd think, the women with a small pelvis and maybe the big baby. It's more to do with the inner pelvic dimensions and the way the baby is actually placed within the
womb. At the risk of a horrendous libel, I would say it's less to do with science and more to do with extracting money from worried mothers.
I thought we were giving everyone elective sections now anyway, so what does it matter?
Exactly, exploit that tocophobia with expensive MRI scans.
I was going to use this as a discovery, but I didn't. But because I thought Mark was going to do that, that topic. Nice, actually have podcasts. I listened to a 5-minute podcast on the new cesarean section guidelines, and it wasn't very informative, but it does kind of sound like basically you can ask for a cesarean section, especially if you're a first-time mother. You then have to go for psychological counselling because of your bizarre choice. And then if you make it through all the runs of psychological counselling, you're still labelled kind of insane, but you get what you want.
And psychological counselling, I think, it can just mean chatting to a midwife.
Oh, okay.
And who hasn't got tocophobia? This is what I don't get. Who hasn't got tocophobia?
I've definitely got tocophobia. Anyway, so yes, the anosmia was the bunkum. There's actually no science behind that at all.
made that up completely.
Gutting. Still, I have heard of it.
The only true bit about that was the word anosmia.
That anosmia does exist, and it does affect your taste. So,
yeah, those are the only facts in that particular article. I just thought it up while I was in the bath. I thought, I wonder if that would work. So if you know someone with anosmia, then send them around to my house because I've got a laser pointer. And we'll,
that was hopeful. My mother had a boss who had a head injury, and everybody who worked for this person thought that the head injury was kind of largely being milked and wasn't that serious. But the one complaint that she kept going on about was anosmia. And my mother obviously kept asking me what I thought of that and what did it mean. And the best I could come up with was farting in her office and waiting to see if there was any reaction.
No.
I'll get back to you with the results of that.
Still not as good as the worst type of osmia you can get, which is cacosmia, which is the imagining of unpleasant odours. Particularly putrefactive odours.
Is that like when you get home after a day of doing something stinky and you think you can still smell it?
I think that's worse, actually.
Okay, step it up. Let's go.
Okay, Bex has got to go.
And a happy new year, everyone.
We'll be back in the new year. Please get in contact if you'd like us to talk about something else other than bad smells on the podcast in 2012. Otherwise, thanks for listening, and we hope you have a very happy holiday season. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.